All right, so I think it's time to move on to Scott Cook's presentation, where, you know, we'll hear at least about Confucius.
The impetus for this paper derives partly from my interest in a number of Kongzi dialogues, things found within the Shanghai Museum manuscripts, in which we find Confucius in conversation not only with disciples, but also with Lord Ai of Lu and the heads of Ji ministerial families. And the attempt to situate these texts have naturally led me, and I'm certainly not the only one involved in this task, of trying to get a better handle on the plethora of early Kongzi materials found scattered throughout the Warring States and early Han works, the richest source of which, outside the Luanyu at least, is to be found in the Liji and Dadai Liji collections. So I thought I'd start by looking at a very small subset of those, framed by a common narrative theme. In this case, the dialogues that explicitly portray the master at leisure in conversation with disciples in a kind of after-hour setting, namely the Zhong Yan Ju, Kongzi Xian Ju, and Zhu Yan, the first two of the Liji and the Zhu Yan chapter of the Dadai Liji. At heart, this paper is a close reading of these texts with an eye towards seeing if they might in any way belong together or in some way serve a common purpose. And though at this point it's still a paper that's very much in progress, I think it's slowly groping towards some sort of conclusion. But in any case, it's a task enormously complicated by the presence of both an excavated manuscript with a couple of manifest crucial differences, being Minzhifumu, or the parent of the people, and parallels in the Kongzi Jiayu that are split up into different chapters, naturally raising the question as to whether the narrative frames in question are even integral to these texts in the first place. Nonetheless, I start my examination from the tentative premise that perhaps they were, if only as a methodological exercise to see where such a premise might lead. Now, according to Zheng Quan, to dwell at ease after leaving court is called yanju, and to avoid other people after leaving a banquet is called xianju. While he thus differentiates the two terms somewhat, the emphasis in both is on an informal and relatively private setting after the conclusion of all the day's official, ceremonial, and diplomatic duties. And the wording of the terms themselves implies just a sense of ease and informality. These definitions aside, our best means of getting a handle on just what sort of situations the terms were meant to describe and the types of conversations they were imagined to facilitate undoubtedly lies within the text themselves, which I'm going to have to race through relatively quickly to try and stay within 20 minutes. So let's start with Zhong Ni Rested at Ease, which begins with an explicit mention of Kongzi taking advantage of the informal after-hours setting to speak freely, Zhong Yan, with a group of disciples about certain matters, hinting perhaps that the circumstances might offer something unique in the way of scope from what he may have spoken to disciples about on other occasions. In this instance, the topic in question is, broadly speaking, ritual. As he says to the three disciples present, "Sit, you three, and I shall tell you about ritual, so that you may smoothly make your rounds in accordance with ritual and lack nothing in the way of breadth or comprehensiveness." Zigong takes initiative to rise up and ask the first question, "May I venture to ask how this is to be done?" To which the master replies, "To be reverent, yet fail to hit the mark in ritual, we call it being wild. To be humble, yet fail to hit the mark, we call it being ingratiating. To be courageous, and yet fail to hit the mark, we call it being defiant," and so on. And eventually, Zigong finally rises once again and asks, "May I venture to ask by what means one may be able to achieve this hitting of the mark?" Which appears to be something of a dumb question, but it's only designed to set up Confucius' emphatic reiteration by way of conclusion. Ritual, ritual, it is ritual by which the central mark is fashioned. So this is a summarizing thought which brings the first section of text to an end, after which it is the second disciple's turn to come to the fore. Ziyo now asking the somewhat leading question, "May I venture to ask whether ritual is that which takes charge of what is flawed and completes what is fine?" The answer is, of course, yes, and Confucius then answers the obligatory request for elaboration by going through a brief list of grand state rituals in which the ruler plays a leading role and ascribing certain functions to each. Generally speaking, the function of these rituals is to humanize or show humanity to both the spirits of the departed and all those among the living who may be brought under ritual sway. The result of such attention to ritual at the highest levels is a ritual modeling that so thoroughly pervades all aspects of social and political life below that everything naturally finds its appropriate measure. As Confucius goes on to elucidate after what is perhaps a further intentional pause, if one were to clearly understand and bring to light the proprieties of the suburban sacrifices, etc., etc., bringing order to the state would surely be as easy as simply pointing it out on the palm of one's hand. And we see in the statements that follow how not only does ritual intrinsically entail hierarchy, but there is, in a sense, also a hierarchy among the rituals themselves, such that those performed at the top radiate on down to those below, and their efficacy is echoed at all levels. Having fleshed out this point, Confucius is not quite done in his response to Ziyo, and he now goes on to pose a question of his own about the very nature of ritual, to which he self replies that it is none other than the ordering of undertakings. He then goes on, after a couple of brief analogies, to basically reformulate what he's just said in the negative. At this point, the master's response to Ziyo has come to a close, and then he proceeds with a further interlude addressed to all three disciples present, in which he states, "Listen carefully, you three, I will tell you how there are yet nine further aspects of ritual, four of which occur within the grand banquet," at which he proceeds to go into some detail regarding the various ritual and musical stages of this particularly meaningful ritual occasion, giving us a level of specificity that we haven't seen elsewhere in this text. What I take to be the four aspects of ritual in question are essentially those phrases highlighted in red here, which is to say that Confucius thought the ultimate functions of ritual to include the realization of humanity, ren, and the exhibition of true affection, qing, charismatic virtue, the, and service to undertakings, or sure. So ritual is primarily concerned at one level with display and exhibition. It's the vehicle of conveyance of sentiments that need not, and indeed largely cannot, be expressed in words alone. As Confucius goes on to stress, in this aspect, the efficacy of ritual can only be fully realized through the assistance of its twin sister, music, as Confucius goes on to spell out in further terms, beginning with the idea that a ritual is ordered pattern, music is rhythmic regularity, and ritual must be balanced with musical expression and infused with inner virtue in order for it to hold any genuine meaning. Finally, Zijang takes his turn, trying to shift the conversation towards what he sees as the separate topic of governance. But in fact, his subject of inquiry turns out to be not so distinct after all, something that apparently doesn't dawn upon him immediately as he feels the need to ask the question a second time, following Confucius' initial response of how the nobleman has a clear understanding of ritual and music and simply raises them up and puts them into place. Zijang's obtuseness prompts Kongzi to go on to stress, or Zhongni to go on and stress how ritual is not really so much about tables and mats, and how music is not really so much about bells and drums, but they are rather speaking words and putting them into practice and finding contentment in one's actions, which will ultimately lead to order and peace throughout the world, and with the result that none will dare to transgress each other's boundaries, all because one sets forth from the path of ritual. In short, ritual effectively is governance. Though this was surely not the first time these disciples had heard such ideas, so central as they are to Confucius' philosophy, the narrative nonetheless does its best to make it seem so, ending most dramatically with a description of how their minds have been utterly blown away by these notions. This is no doubt the effect the author of this text wished it to have on its contemporary readers as well. So I'll skip my structural summary here and turn on to the second of our texts, in which Confucius appears alone with only one disciple. Here, Zixia begins by simply asking the question, "An ode states, harmonious and genial is the noble man, parent of the people. May I ask what one must be like in order to be called parent of the people?" To which Kongzi replies that the parent of the people is one who must comprehend the source of ritual and music so as to achieve the five attainments and practice the three absences and thereby transfuse the world, along with a couple of other things. So in contrast to the previous text, this one begins not with Confucius bringing up a topic he suddenly has the inspiration to discuss in the casual presence of three disciples, but rather has a single disciple, Zixia, pose the question that will lead to a profound and wide-ranging discourse, utilizing a vehicle of conversation that is both a hallmark of Confucius' instruction and an area of inquiry in which Zixia himself was particularly well-versed, the interpretation of a line from the Odes. Confucius is then prodded, as usual, for elaboration upon his initially somewhat opaque answer, which in this case defines the notion of parent of the people in such vague terms as the five attainments and three absences. Confucius then elaborates by defining the former in terms of a chain of causation. Wherever one's intent reaches, poetry also attains. Wherever poetry reaches, ritual also attains, and so on down the line, ritual and music. Whether his answer really clarifies things so much is debatable, but Zixia has at least given the reference to the five attainments that he is looking for. Though vaguely worded, the statement would appear to suggest a typical Confucian program in which ritual and music serve to guide human affections in their inevitable reactions to things and events, keeping them in balance so as to not let the pendulum of emotions swing too far in either direction, while still providing a proper outlet for natural human sentiments. Here I'll have to skip the somewhat interesting variations that are found in the excavated version, and simply note that in the Li Ji version, the role of poetry in this causal chain might possibly suggest something in the way of approbation or justification for the way in which Zixia initiated the dialogue, that is, by citing one of the odes. Zixia then continues to inquire about the three absences, once more seeking the aid of lines from the odes in the process, and Confucius defines the three absences as the music of no sounds, the ritual of no bodily deportment, and the mourning of no apparel. Essentially, the stuff of music and ritual, which, though itself invisible and inaudible, carries an energy that fills the expanse between heaven and earth. Zixia again follows up by asking which odes might best express these notions, and Confucius readily supplies them. Despite their arcane language, the lines from these odes really do give one a more direct sense of what the immensely abstract three absences actually entail. Generally speaking, in all these, it is that spirit that infuses music, ritual, and mourning practices, and the foundation upon which those practices rest, and which gives them their meaning. Yet, while the ode citations have helped him to see all of this, Zixia is still left wanting more, prompting Confucius to bring up a mysterious five arisings that come from these three absences, which he then fleshes out vaguely in through a kind of five-line poem. And it's hardly surprising that the ultimate import of such an abstract concept as the three absences could be described in anything less arcane than such a series of rhymed triplets, which derive their strength, I think, as much from the coherence of the prosody as they do from the content inscribed within them. And again, I'm going to have to skip over some of the discussion of the variations to be found here in the excavated version. More significantly, though, is the fact that the text of Mingzhi Fumu, the excavated text, clearly ends at this point and contains none of the subsequent paragraphs of text found in the received text. So either the scribe of Mingzhi Fumu simply copied down, purposes uncertain, what he considered the core portion of an originally lengthier text, or else it in fact closely resembles an originally shorter text upon which the author of Kongzi Xianju attempted, for one reason or another, to expand. But if the latter is true, then he went about such expansion with great care indeed, as what follows adheres closely to the style of what precedes. Zixia's next question indeed tightly mirrors the wording of the first, and in response to it, the master gives only a brief answer, compelling Zixia to once again request for elaboration, to which the master replies as follows here. As Zixia has now opened up a whole new line of questioning, it's easy to see how all the following passages could have been treated as more or less a separate text altogether. The passages preceding this having all arisen from the question of what the parent of the people, these now turn to the separate, though not unrelated, issue of forming a triad with heaven and earth. As with his initial answer to the previous question, Kongzi gives his preliminary brief response in the form of an enumerated concept, the three absences of partiality, sanwusi. And following the requisite elaboration, he goes on once again to finally provide poetic substantiation for this notion in the lines of the odes, this time without Zixia's prompting. Then Kongzi goes on to elaborate further, discussing how in their life-giving and life-nurturing operations, heaven and earth serve as instructional models for the human sovereign below. And then Kongzi elaborates even further again, not only continuing to cite the odes for Zixia, he precedes the citation here with some more poetry of his own, such that we have an ode within an ode and a concrete historical example embedded with a poetic expression of the more general principle. Finally, Kongzi concludes what turns out to be a kind of mini lecture here as follows, citing further odes in praise of select kings from antiquity who were emblematic of the concepts just elaborated. So to sum up here, while centered around two main questions, Kongzi Xianju nonetheless presents itself as an integrally unified piece with a relatively consistent style of exposition and logically developing structure. Nonetheless, the fact that both the excavated manuscript Mingzhi Fumu and the Luanli chapter of the Kongzi Jiayu present the text in abbreviated form, the question naturally arises as to whether the text as we have it in the Li Ji accurately reflects the text as first conceived, or is it in fact the result of some process of accretion? Given also that, and I think I haven't mentioned this fact yet, that Mingzhi Fumu lacks the narrative frame of Kongzi rested at leisure, right, the initial phrase we find at the head of the Li Ji text, Some scholars have argued, Matthias Richter among others, that Yizhifumu represents the earliest stage of the text, among the three anyway, and that the narrative frame of Kongzi Xianzhu was added to it only after the text came to be placed immediately after Zhong Yianzhu in the Liqi collection, as a kind of means for creating greater coherence between the two subsequent chapters. The Kongzi Jiayu chapter in turn intentionally merged these two originally separate texts, or the bulk of them anyway, into a single chapter. Now the second claim I have no problem with, and I think is in fact readily clear from even a cursory comparison of the Kongzi Jiayu parallels with their Liji predecessors. But the former claim is one I remain skeptical of, and I think both the evidence and motive for such an editorial move are relatively lacking, and that it's just as possible that the excavated text was in fact abridged from a larger text in which that narrative frame was already present, simplifying the introduction in order to focus more exclusively on the content of the extracted passage, while Kongzi Xianzhu was placed together with Zhong Yianzhu in the Liji collection precisely because it already shared the same type of narrative frame, or perhaps even because it was seen as closely akin to it, both stylistically and philosophically. So tentatively, I concluded the paper as written with a promise to explore a couple of points. First, I note, expanding on Zheng Xuan's definition of the terms Yianzhu and Xianzhu, how they appear to point to the notion of privacy, or a situation that allows for both deeper reflection and the discussion of things that might not normally be conversed upon in more public settings, and how we should thus expect that the discussions framed within such a narrative context would indeed reveal unique functions not found, unique features not found in others whose context is otherwise. And the second point I wanted to explore was the necessary prerequisite to that one, that of whether these texts can in fact be reliably read as coherent units in the first place, and especially whether, beyond their common narrative frames, they might indeed bear close relationship to one another. I hadn't yet then gotten around to examining the Julian chapter, but it turns out that it does prove relatively helpful in pointing towards answers to both points. First, in terms of the role of the narrative frame, Julian proves to be even more self-consciously deliberate with the crafting of its narratives than the previous one. The previous two. It begins by stating that Kongzi rested at leisure with Zhengzi in attendance. And the conversation begins with Kongzi calling out Zhengzi and lamenting that the so-called noble men of today rarely speak of the proper way of the sovereign, and that tragically, Confucius seems destined to go to the grave before his doctrine on the matter, the discourse of the sovereign, might ever be implemented. Zhengzi arises from his mat and says, "Dare I ask to what the discourse of the sovereign refers?" Most dramatically, Kongzi remains silent, causing Zhengzi to grow fearful, alight from his mat, and apologize for his lack of humility in asking the question, saying that he dared only ask because it's not easy to find a moment with the master at leisure. At this, Kongzi still remains silent, causing Zhengzi to grow even more fearful and recede to stand with his back to the wall. Only with this gesture of the disciple's great humility does Kongzi speak, clearly wishing to get the matter off his chest, yet nonetheless rebuking his disciple in the process, saying, "Shen, do you think you are worthy of discussing the way of enlightened ruler with?" Zhengzi, of course, professes he would never dare to be so audacious, and once again reiterates that he only dared to ask because it's not easy to find a moment with the master at leisure. So clearly the narrative frame has set up the expectation of a discourse that is at once urgent, esoteric, and extraordinary. And having now achieved that purpose, Kongzi finally relents in his didactic posturing, replying to Zhengzi with simply, "Okay, I'll tell you," and then proceeding with the content of the discourse proper. So in this text, the narrative frame of the master at leisure, I think, reveals its purpose most explicitly, and it is indeed just as we expected. And to the point of whether the text in questions might meaningfully be treated as a kind of coherent group in the first place, I already noted in the paper how the first two texts share an undeniably close philosophical viewpoint. I think I'm almost out of time, so I'll skip most of that and just note my conclusion to that was that, how ideas such as the music, is ritual really about tables and mats, music about bells and drums, etc., in Zhong Yianzhu seemed to be, precisely the idea of the music of no sounds and ritual of no bodily deportment that filled the expanse between heaven and earth in the Kongzi Xianzhu, save for the fact that the latter expresses such ideas directly in abstract generalities, whereas the former draws them out more gradually from the description of relatively concrete ceremonial institutions. But one could always make the argument that such notions really lie at the very heart of Confucian thought more generally. So if we want to demonstrate a substantially closer relationship between between these texts, we need to see more in the way of direct linguistic correspondence or other forms of evidence. And so finally, Julianne, as it turns out, is also fascinating in this regard. And I'll have to skip through some of these, skip through the details, but you see things like Nei Shou Qi Zheng Wai Xing San Zhi, both similarities in both the method of enumeration and specific terminology, phrases, ideas like Bu Xia Xi or Tian Xia Zhi, one the world's put in order without ever getting off his mat. All the way down to, I think this last bit is in red here is worth quoting, where we have Kongzi giving a response about the three attainments that sounds alarmingly like the three absences that we heard of in the Kongzi Xianju text, right? The ultimate attainment in ritual is such that without any gestures of yielding, the world is put in order. The ultimate attainment in rewarding is such that without any expenditures, the world's men of talent are pleased. The ultimate attainment in musical expression is such that without any sounds, the world of the people are in harmony. I could go on, but I think it should be fairly clear by now that the points of overlap between with Kongzi Xianju especially are fairly astounding. And it's evident that if nothing else, there's at least probably some sort of conscious imitation taking place here. So finally, I'll leave you with this chart, which takes note of some shared unique language among these three particular texts. From enumerated jurists, philosophical concepts, to somewhat seemingly more innocuous disciple questions as Ganwen He Ru or even Ganwen He Wei, or even ways in which the master addresses his disciples, such as Er Yi Wei or Wu Yi Wei, zen me yang, or somewhat less exclusively, perhaps Wu Yu Ru, and so on. Right? To make a long story short, the wordings of our three texts in question show great commonalities with each other, but relatively little else in the Li Ji and Da Dai Li Ji corpuses. With the fascinating exception of the Ai Gong Wen chapters and a couple of Confucius dialogues in the Yue Ji, a point that needs, I think, to be explored further. Outside these two Li Ji corpuses, the terms appear to be found mostly in consciously derivative texts, such as the Confucius dialogues in the Zhuangzi, for instance, perhaps pointing to the fact that these particular texts, Kongzi Xianju and the like, were in fact greatly studied and consciously imitated as the standard Kongzi, as standard Kongzi dialogue texts in the late Warring States. So given all this, my tentative conclusion here is that we do need to take the Confucius at Leisure text more seriously as a kind of self-conscious genre, if not perhaps even a group of texts that shared common authorship. And the fact that an excavated version of the Kongzi Xianju is found lacking its narrative frame should not so readily be taken to indicate that that narrative frame was not, in fact, integral to the original text as first conceived. In short, I think we just might still be well justified in speaking in terms of authorial intent when it comes to the narrative frame of such a text rather than those of merely editorial intent. Right, thank you.
Thank you, Scott, for taking us into the thick of, textual history and textual controversies, and also into the thick of ongoing discussions about Confucius being dragged into this whole, ritual literature, we saw these titles saying, Confucius at Leisure, etc., Confucius After Hours, I mean, to quote you, Scott, but... listening to you, I kept thinking, are we talking about some kind of apocryphal Confucius, actually? That's the whole problem. Mm-hmm.